and welcome to another episode of Unauthorized Disclosure. I am one of your hosts, Rania Kalik, and I'm here with my other host, Kevin Gastola.
Hello.
And we're really excited to be speaking today with two people. Aviva Stahl is an independent journalist, and we're going to be speaking with her about the article she just wrote, which we'll get to in a moment. And we're also joined by Abraham Paulos, who's the executive director of Families for Freedom, which is related to what we were going to be speaking to Aviva about. So I guess, well, first of all, thank you so much for joining us, you guys.
Thanks for having me.
And Aviva, let's start with you. You wrote this article for Vice. British and American immigrant detainees are going on hunger strikes for the same rights. So why don't you give us some background on what's happening?
Sure. Earlier this month in the UK, hundreds of immigrant detainees went on hunger strike, which was kind of the largest protest migration, the largest protest that activists have seen in a long time. And it also happened to occur at the 1 year anniversary of the hunger strikes at Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, Washington. And I thought it was just really important to draw out the kind of parallels in the way that migrants on both sides of the Atlantic are resisting their detention, but also the cultures of criminalization that shape migrant realities in both contexts, both for people inside detention and for people on the outside.
In terms of some of those similarities, you know, you mentioned that in certain cases, like some of the same private prison operators are running the detention facilities where there's hunger strikes in the UK, as is the case with the US with GEO Group, I think you mentioned, right?
Yeah, so a lot of the same private corporations run detention centers in both countries. I mean, I think privatization is really prominent in the immigration context in both countries. So the GEO Group, G4S, kind of a broad array of the corporate evils that are really visible in our detention centers.
Well, what I found really, really striking, though, was the methods being used, like sort of explicitly, for crushing any sort of civil disobedience inside these detention facilities. And just to clarify, I mean, these aren't, not that, you know, it's okay to torture prisoners who've committed crimes, but it's important for people to understand that when it comes to the immigration detention context, I mean, these are largely people who've committed no crimes except maybe coming into the country without papers. But yeah, so can you talk a little bit about the policies and procedures that the UK seems to be adopting from the US, if anything, to crush hunger strikes?
Sure. I mean, I think something really important to say first is that for a lot of people in detention, hunger strikes is one way that they can resist nonviolently. It's one of the few ways that they can resist their detention. So I think, and you know, on the outside, obviously, the most important thing is for advocates and activists to raise visible support. So I think a lot of the tactics for repressing hunger strikes in detention centers center around ways to either prevent their communication with the outside world, or to threaten them, or to like break down communication between people on the inside. So I think in both the U.S. and the U.K., people on hunger strikes have been thrown in solitary confinement. A lot of times, immigration officials will move around the leaders of the hunger strike, move them around to detention centers. Or I think most recently in the U.K., a lot of the participants had their deportations expedited. So they were just removed from the country. And in the U.S. even, at the Northwest Detention Center, detainees were threatened with kind of Guantanamo-style force feeding, which obviously is pretty grotesque. So,
And I guess also I should ask, like, if you want to talk for a moment about why people are going on hunger strike, that's sort of, I guess, that's the main point here as well. What is it that's taking place in these facilities?
Sure. I mean, I don't want to say the two contexts are exactly the same, but I think kind of one overarching issue that detainees in both countries face is that currently there aren't really strict limitations on how long people can be held in immigration detention. And the UK is actually the only country within the EU where there isn't a maximum amount of time that people can be held. So I think that's one thing, but a lot of the other things are similar. You know, people don't have automatic access to bail hearings, and then just the conditions inside the detention centers themselves. So sexual and physical harassment from guards, really poor access to medical treatment, bad food, filthy facilities. And if you're interested in learning more about conditions inside the UK, Channel 4 News in the UK has released a couple of videos from inside Corporate Watch, which is an organization that does research on kind of around corporate accountability, has also released some videos. So I definitely encourage you guys to watch them if you are interested.
And then, Abraham, we can bring you in as well. If you want to talk a little bit, it'd be great about this history of trying to sort of make immigrants out as criminals, or sort of equate them with criminals in a way where immigration or foreignness has become like the equivalent of criminality.
Right. Well, I mean, I can speak really about the United States and sort of its history. And in particular, I like to start with the Immigration Act of 1964. Now, before the Immigration Act of 1964, immigrants in the U.S. have never been welcomed. I mean, I know that there's this narrative that the U.S. sort of welcomes all immigrants and it's a nation of immigrants, and it might be a nation of immigrants, but it's never been sort of this type of welcoming party that we all think and that we were all accepted and tolerated. But I'd really like to start from the 1964 Immigration Act, because that really did away with a lot of the preferences for immigrants coming from Europe. And so by the 1980s, because of this act, most immigrants who were coming to the U.S. were coming from South America, Africa, Asia, and in particular the Caribbean. Now, if you look at what was going on with the 80s, you had sort of the war on drugs, the war on poverty, and the 1988 Anti-Drug Abuse Act was the first time where you start to see this bonding of the criminal system and the immigration system. And in particular, in the act, what it did was that it made certain offenses deportable, that basically said, particularly drug offenses. And so you start to sort of see by policy and by law, right, which is like criminalization. And the definition that I use of criminalization is sort of the adjudication of law and then enforcing that law. So by 1988, you really start to see by policy and law these two systems kind of colliding. But in particular, the 1996 laws were really way more important than what happened in 1988. And the 1996 laws that were passed basically have given the landscape for the, almost 500,000 deportations that we see, the detention situation. And, the laws that came out in 1996, it's the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act. I know it's a long name, but the acronym is IRA-IRA, and the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act. So these two laws came out of a context, and they came out of the context of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, and it also came out of the context of the Oklahoma City bombing. And so you start to see this narrative, through the media about immigrants being a threat to national security and immigrants being criminals. What the 1996 laws did in general is that it expanded crimes where someone could get deported for. It also made it retroactive, meaning that, it didn't matter if you committed a crime after the law went into effect. It just meant if you committed a crime at all. And more importantly, which is what Aviva was talking about like sort of the hunger strikes and the detention policies, is that it made detention mandatory and that it made deportation mandatory. And what that means in layman's terms is that you don't get a bond. So once you get into an immigration prison, if you're considered a category called aggravated felon, but that doesn't really mean anything in sort of the criminal system, it's just an immigration term, but you don't get a bond. And so you are then put in prison through this quote-unquote administrative process where you don't get all the rights that you would as someone that was doing state or federal time. And then you're also mandatorily deportable, and you don't have the right to counsel. And so in that sense, you sort of start to see that the idea that the immigrant sort of coming to take jobs, or the immigrant drug dealing, and the immigrant sort of being this like evil boogeyman. And a lot of that really has to do with like when we start coming into this country. And that was during the 80s and 90s, where more than 80% of us were poor people and people of color going into communities where it's poor people and people of color that are already highly criminalized and already over-policed. So I would just probably say that it really started in the 80s and 90s as far as context goes.
Great. And then also, since 9/11, it seems like that's sort of been another round of making this you know system and framework that criminalizes immigrants even more harsh.
Correct. I mean, what 9/11 did is that, like, 9/11 didn't really change the law, right? Like, really, it's been since 1996. But what 9/11 did, it was giving the government sort of the political power, and, you know, and society was like, all right, well, we need to do something to sort of ramp up that enforcement, to go back to the books and say, oh, my God, like, look, we have laws where we can lock people up and not give them bond and put them in prisons where, you know, they get mistreated, put them in prisons where we don't really have to care for them. A great example of this is a jail in Alabama called Etowah County Detention Center. Now, Etowah County Detention Center was actually built for terrorists, right? I think it holds about 300 or 400 in different units, but it was built for terrorists, but they weren't any. They couldn't find any. You know, they probably caught like four or five. So then what are we going to do with this prison that we just built for these, you know, evil people? Well, let's just put immigrants in there. And so 9/11, what it did is just it gave resources, right, billions of dollars to start an agency like the Department of Homeland Security, and then basically said, okay, well, now we can have another agency called Immigration Customs Enforcement, so we can go out and, you know, chase people, pick them up at their homes in front of their daughters, pick them up at jails. And so what 9/11 did was just give it that reinforcement that it really needed. And now we're sort of snowballing into a situation where people have adapted to the idea of locking up people for, like you said, a civil offense. You know, this is a civil violation. It is not a crime.
If it's all right, just kind of draw on what Abraham was saying and talk about the way that migrants are being criminalized more broadly in the UK, if that's all right.
Oh, please do, yeah.
Okay, I mean, I think just if we can even look at the Immigration Act that was passed last year in the UK. So in part that, like, specifically took away rights from, you know, so-called foreign prisoners. So already, like in the US, people who are migrants who don't have citizenship and who are convicted of, like, offenses, I think it's more than 12, they serve terms of more than 12 months in the UK, already they, basically mandated to be deported, and they can't access bail, so a lot of, like, similar circumstances. But the act that was passed last year essentially said that, and, you know, in the EU, there's, like, an article of rights, and, like, essentially human rights, and the Immigration Act detailed that immigrants weren't, had, like, sorry, I just hear something in the background, but it's fine.
Oh, it's good. Nice background music.
That people had, like, less access to stay on the basis of having, like, family rights. So if it's a human right to have access to your family, to stay with your family, to be in the same country as your family, the Immigration Act essentially said, well, now, like, foreign migrants who are convicted of crimes are, like, essentially less than human, that they don't have the same right as everyone else to be in the country where their family is, and that we're not going to consider that right as important when we determine whether they're going to be deported or not. So the act, like, very specifically denied, like, foreign migrants convicted of crimes lesser rights. But in other ways, it also just expanded more broadly the criminalization of being undocumented. Mm-hmm. So the act requires landlords to check status for people before renting, and it also kind of prohibits banks to give just, like, checking accounts to people who are to people who are undocumented. So I think that you can see, too, this relationship, like, we have to recognize that the relationship between the criminalization of foreign prisoners and the criminalization of migrants at large, just their movement, that those are linked.
Could either of you address how this criminalization is disrupting or foreclosing the ability to get asylum?
Sure. I mean, I think in the U.S. context, it's you know, those 1996 laws, again, that passed. One of the major differences was that the amount of time that you can file for asylum. Now, before, it was pretty open-ended that at any time in your life or your stay in the U.S., that if you were approached by immigration authorities and they wanted to deport you, that you could make a claim and say, look, you know, I can't go back because of asylum and persecution. But the law that changed in 1996 basically said you had to do it within a year, right? And so, I mean, what that means is that people coming from traumatic experiences, right? Now, a year might seem like a long time or enough time in a bureaucratic sense, but when we were looking at, like, people's lived experiences, like, a year is definitely not enough, right? And it needs to be, the way that I feel, I mean, I think it needs to, that law needs to be repealed. Also, another issue with asylum is that it's getting harder and harder to get. And if you do have a criminal conviction, that you're not awarded asylum, right? That just sort of means that you have to then apply for Convention Against Torture, which is an international standard, or what's known as, like, withholding, basically to say, you can't deport me to this country. And the government can then turn around and say, okay, well, we're going to deport you to another country. And so I think that the issue with asylum and persecution and what we're really going through, the bottom line is this, is that they don't want us here, right? And that no matter what our arguments might be for, you know, violence in our home country, such as Mexico, which is really hard to get asylum from Mexico, or the earthquake that happened in Haiti, right? Like, a lot of these issues that would normally, you know, be like, yes, that's probably a good idea that we give these people some type of safety and refuge, is now a lot harder to do.
I mean, I think also in the UK, there's kind of this narrative around the bogus asylum seeker, you know, people fabricating claims, people basically the assumption that people who are undocumented, people come to the country, that they're liars, that they'll say whatever they can or do whatever they can to get papers. And this assumption that they're inherently untrustworthy because they're people of color or, you know, because they're not, like, quote, legal migrants.
And I also would be interested if either of you want to speak to how the immigration detention system has expanded under President Barack Obama.
It's expanded under President Barack Obama. And you know, obviously, I'm the first to go against any administration in the U.S. would be highly critical of it. But I also, again, want to drop some context to it. Like, these laws were already laid out, right? George Bush also started, you know, locking immigrants up in these detention centers. It really started after the 90s. Now, before, you know, if you were up to deportation, they would basically send you a letter in the mail and say, come to court because we don't think you should be here. And that was a great majority of, you know, removal cases or deportation proceedings. Now, all of a sudden, it's this issue of just saying, no, like, we have to lock them all up and keep them locked up without a lawyer, or without bond, without access to a lawyer. And so that expansion, I think, coincides with the expansion of mass incarceration in this country, right? It sort of expands with this whole concept of prisons growing everywhere in the world. And I know in Europe, and I can't speak too much to it, but, you know, the idea of, like, okay, well, we're going to use prisons as a solution, right, to our problems, and it never really is, but it's this expansion of it. And I'd like to drop the fact that also privatization, right, these for-profit companies are now being able to go to these governments and say, hey, you know you have a problem with these poor black and brown people, and we have a solution, and the solution is to lock them up. And the difference between private and public, like, if you look at in this country, in the U.S., public prisons and jails, right, I believe about, 15% are privatized. But when you look at the immigration prisons, right, you're looking at about 50% of immigrants who are locked up in prisons are in privatized situations. So that's a lot of money, you know, and I think looking at sort of the historical context of, you know, being a person of color, being poor, like, money has always been made sort of off our misery in many ways than one, but prisons are now becoming sort of this you know, close to final solution to, you know, whatever that they say, crime, poverty, you know. And so that's kind of how I feel that the expansion has actually grown with the expansion of just mass incarceration.
Well, I wonder if either of you can also speak to, you know, because what is happening under Barack Obama that's, I think, very new is the actual, like, the actual detention of families. And I don't know that this is happening in the UK as well, but from after last year with the large influx of like children, unaccompanied children, fleeing violence in Central America and, in some cases families coming in, there's like a couple facilities that have popped up in Texas and Arizona, privately run detention facilities that are actually holding mothers and children. You know, so is this something that's like new? Are there laws for this in the U.S. that make this okay? And is this something that's happening in Europe or at least in the U.K. as well?
I mean, Abraham, I don't know if you want to speak to the legal context in the U.S.
I don't think there. I mean, it's happened before. There was a facility in Texas, but I would agree that it is now that is new and special because. Folks had fought for that, you know, like the advocacy community was just like, you are literally out of your mind to lock up families. Like what type of legal reasoning do they have for that? I don't even know because I'm so baffled by what type of moral reasoning do you have to lock up a family? I mean, it blows my mind. But as far as Europe, I mean, I think, you know, Aviva, if you can talk, I mean, I'd like to know more. Are they locking up families in Europe too?
I mean, I think it has been one of the kind of fights in England has been around holding children and families. I think in general, there have been like some wins in terms of reducing like when children can be held. But I know, like, for example, Barnardo's was involved, like, the charity was involved in like helping run detention centers. So I think there have been like similar fights in the UK along like when and how to hold children and families who are asylum seekers or undocumented.
Okay, so what you're saying is the U.S. is the leader. We're winning in moral depravity.
As always.
Exactly. No, I mean, no, but it is really, I mean, it is a really shocking, I mean, it is, it's like, how do you even, I can't even really wrap my head around that there's like actual, like, moms and their kids, like, in, like, a prison, for coming into the U.S. I mean, it's lunacy, and I don't know I guess we'll all have to look into that some more. I'm not really sure, like, why, how that's okay. But I mean, it is happening under Obama. And just to go back to that for a moment, you know, obviously these laws have been in place, but Obama has deported more people, than any other president. You know, people are locked up. I mean, the detention apparatus has grown like tremendously under him. And I think that just goes to show, I mean, it's like a bipartisan thing, right? Like, this kind of treatment, this harsh treatment, this criminal treatment of migrants. Is that just like the trajectory, like the sort of inevitable trajectory of like where we're headed just because of like the way these laws are set up?
I hate the word inevitable, but the trajectory part, I'm with you on that. I mean, I think it is a trajectory, and I think what Obama, I mean, I think the biggest disappointment is that you would think that someone who has some type of constitutional reasoning, right? He was a professor of constitutional law to sort of say, like, this is how we're going to go through with it. But is it, and it is bipartisan, right? I mean, that's just the way that the government is or Congress is. And really looking at Congress, I mean, Congress is just a bunch of millionaires, right, that are doing what they're supposed to be doing. So I don't really think that a bunch of millionaires in D.C. really care about my community or about my family. Is it the trajectory? Yeah. And it's looking really bad right now as far as, you know, the slippery slope of logic. Like, if you're going to lock up families, mothers, and children, like, that is a slippery slope. You've already opened the door to say that this is okay. And, you know, the numbers under him have been quite crazy. I mean, we're looking at 2 million that actually were forced out of the country. And then there's actually a bunch more, you know, hundreds of thousands of other folks that basically signed out, particularly in the Central American community. But if, you know, Families for Freedom, you know, we're an organization, a human rights organization that's been sort of fighting this for about 12 years. Now, if you look at our, you know, time span, we're looking at like 7 million, you know, people that have like been forced out of the U.S. And that no longer really becomes a domestic type of a question, but it's like, what does this mean for the international community? And I know Aviva brought up, you know, the, dare I say, human rights, but brought up that term, and it's like, okay, now we've got to look at this as like forced migration all around the world, and how are we going to deal with it as, you know, international community, or how are we going to deal with it even with the receiving countries who are already strained, who have already been, you know, robbed by colonialism and whatever, all that. And so the trajectory aspect of it, it's not looking good.
Yeah, no, that actually kind of is one last thing I wanted to touch on, is the fact that, like, you know, in, at least in the case of Europe and what it's dealing with in terms of, like, refugees or, like, dying on boats, because there's, like, this refugee crisis in, like, North Africa and the Middle East that's, like, unprecedented. I think it's, like, since World War II, like, there haven't been refugees, this many, you know, refugees, like, fleeing violence like this. And so, yeah, I mean, Aviva, like, in terms of Europe and the UK, it's, like, you know, what does this mean moving forward? I mean, are we going to keep seeing people just, like, perish and die in the hundreds in boats and being, like, put into immigration, to, you know, into, like, basically concentrated into immigration camps? I don't know what else to call them. I mean, they really are, like, you know, detention concentration camps. But, yeah, is this, like, something that's going to continue to happen? And what can people do? I mean, it kind of starts to feel a little desperate and hopeless.
Yeah, I mean, I also don't want to, like, frame things as inevitably bad, yeah. But I do think in Europe, for sure, there's just an increasingly vitriolic debate about immigration and asylum seekers. I think especially Europe's seen austerity measures in a way that the U.S. hasn't, like, quite to the same extent. And definitely, like, migrants are becoming the scapegoat for, like, cuts to public services that are having real and profound effects on people's everyday lives. And it's, I think that's, you know, a lot of Europe is struggling with, a lot of the left is struggling with, how do we hold, like, corporations accountable? How do we hold mainstream political parties accountable and shift the discourse away from blaming migrants for, like, quote, taking away our jobs or using our public services? And I definitely think if you look at kind of the rise of the far right in the UK and the rest of Europe, you can see, like, a direct relationship to the rhetoric around migration. And yeah, it's pretty dire.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't need to leave it all on, like, this awful, horrible note, but it just, yeah, it's like I'm not really sure how else to look at, like, the imprisonment of, like, all these people and then, like, sort of these walls being built everywhere to keep anyone else out.
I mean, I think, you know, on a optimistic note, yeah. I think you can always look at the kind of individual stories of solidarity, like, you know, between the outside and the inside of migration, of detention centers, or look at, you know, even when I was interviewing people detained in the UK and interviewing some of the former hunger strikers from last year to find ways to communicate between people across borders or between walls. I think that can always be one source of, like, support or one source of optimism.
No, that's totally true. And there's stuff that, like, Abraham, your organization does. And then I know there's, like, all the kinds of activism taking place around this issue, especially from communities being affected. And I think that's excellent. Before we wrap up, is there anything that you'd like to direct people to, for, like, more information or to get involved in stuff around this issue?
Sure. I think if people want to learn more about the UK context, there's a website called Detained Voices. I think it's detainedvoices.wordpress.com. And basically, like, activists on the outside are posting narratives and quotes from people who are on the inside. So if you want to read kind of the direct experiences of people who are in detention, I definitely encourage you to check out that website. And then I think I mentioned this earlier, but Corporate Watch does a lot of really good research. Mm-hmm. So you could always check out their website.
And Abraham, did you want to add something to that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think Aviva kind of broke it down. I mean, I think here in the U.S., if you really want to know, like, know more, Detention Watch Network is a good place. Families for Freedom.org is also a good place. But to leave it on a light note, because I felt like it got kind of dark there. But to leave it on a light note, I mean, I think it really just means around organizing, right? Being political about the issue. And, you know, if you're coming from a community where it's poor people of color, like, we need to understand that these, you know, injustice to our community is nothing new. This is just a new label or a new packaging that they're coming with it, basically saying, oh, well, now we're migrants when before we were sort of colonial subjects, you know? Mm-hmm. And so to really just sort of look at it and say, okay, well, we will continue to struggle. We will continue to fight for our rights. And I think one of the things that this is doing is actually helping us connect the dots by saying, okay, well, our struggle in New York is about the same as the struggle in London, or what people are going through in Paris, or what people are going through in North Africa. So what it does on a light note is that it allows us to sort of make those connections and connect those dots and say, this is actually happening all around. And we need to fight, basically.
Well said. Thank you so much, you guys, for coming on and talking to us about this incredibly important issue. We hope to hear from you again soon.
Thanks for having me.
Great. Thank you.
Lots of world developments that we wanted to talk about this week, particularly the Saudi-led coalition of tyrannical governments that is bombing the country of Yemen right now, and doing so with the critical support of the United States. But Ronny Kalik is in San Francisco, California this weekend, speaking at the 8th Annual Arab Women's Conference. So we made the decision to not do a discussion segment and just let the interview segment stand alone for this week's episode. If possible, we'll be back next week with another episode. But in the meantime, thank you for listening and good luck.